Sorry to be out of the meditation hall so much today and miss so many of Jonas's teachings, but I was glad to catch the end of the chair yoga. So many ways to take care of the body. And it was really a delight and an honor to get to compare notes with most of us about how it's going, what you're noticing in the practice. And if you didn't get to come and you'd like to, we'll continue that tomorrow morning. And then I guess we'll probably take a little break till the next day, and then we'll have the opportunity to speak to Jonas as well. So somebody reminded me of this poem, short poem, supposedly written illicitly during a meditation retreat. Enough. These few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here. This opening to the life we have refused. Again and again. Until now. Until now. Enough, these few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here, this opening to the life we refused again and again, until now, until now. That's David White, Welsh poet, and probably the only poet in the world who makes a living doing corporate training. Interesting guy. So returning to the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutra teachings on the four foundations of mindfulness. So I'll say a little more about the body section, because the body section is by far and away the longest, which already I think is an interesting fact in and of itself. I didn't count pages, but there are, you know, a little introduction, and then there's information about each of these four different foundations, these four areas to practice mindfulness in, and the body section is maybe like a half of the entire thing. So we talked about breathing, and Jonas talked very eloquently last night about the position of the body, knowing where the body is in space. And there's a few more sections that are worth mentioning briefly. The last part that Jonas didn't have time to get to is present in all four of these foundations, which is that after really getting to know and being able to identify clearly the objects of in the foundation, the stuff, once we really get to know the stuff in the foundation, the Buddha suggests some contemplations on the nature of that stuff. What are the qualities of that stuff? What is the real sort of essence of what this thing is? And so, not surprisingly, that's a pretty rich inquiry when we think about the body. What is the nature of the body? We become aware of the body in the present moment, partly through this intimacy with breathing. Become aware of how the body feels, where the body is in space. But what is the body anyway, right? We've been using this shorthand four-letter English word, the body, as if that meant something. What is that? You know, what does that actually mean? Maybe like everything under the sun, each of us has a little different idea. So one of the ways the Buddha suggests looking at the body in detail is to look at all the pieces and parts of the body. So here the body scan maybe is a reference to this in some way. He uses a few analogies. I'll just read you one of them. Bhikkhus, imagine a sack which can be opened at both ends, containing a variety of grains: brown rice, wild rice, mung beans, kidney beans, sesame, white rice. When someone with good eyesight opens the bag, he'll review it like this. This is brown rice, this is wild rice, these are the mung beans, these are kidney beans, these are sesame seeds, this is white rice. Just so, the practitioner passes in review of the whole of the body, from the soles of the feet to the hair at the top of the head, a body enclosed in a layer of skin and full of all the impurities. It says impurities, interestingly. All the impurities, all the elements which belong to the body. Here's the hair of the head, the hairs on the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, bowels, excrement, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, saliva, mucus, synovic fluid, and urine. So I guess that was the Indian understanding of the body at 500 BC, Gray's Anatomy. So to really identify the elements of the body. So we do that. We do that practice. And not just to like get smart about the body or something, but because somehow it's a part of this project. Somehow it's going to help us be mindfully aware. So that's interesting. Another way it talks about the composition of the body, the nature of the body, is by using 5th century BC physics. This was 15th century BC medicine, now we have physics. The elements. What are the elements that make up the body? The four classical elements of fire, water, earth, and wind. Later on, the Buddhists add space, by the way. They figured out you need that too. Nothing works out. So what's cool is we can actually experience these four elements of the nature of the body directly. Let's do a little meditation. So ground yourself a little bit. And bring your awareness to your mouth. Breathing in, breathing out, noticing the feelings and sensations and structures you can feel in the mouth. So let's tune in first to the water element. What is it to really feel directly and experience the water element in the mouth, the moistness in the mouth? What is that moistness really like? Can you really know it? Does the quality of water change as you examine it? And then let's consider the earth element by considering the teeth, little stones in our own mouth, strong and hard, you know, rooted. So contemplating the teeth, can you feel the teeth directly or the place where the teeth are? What is the feeling of earth in the mouth? Perhaps accessed through wondering about the solidity of the teeth. And then wind is pretty easy. Feeling the movement of breath. The movement of the air in the mouth. And noticing that even if you breathe predominantly through the nose, as recommended, we do, there's still movement of air, of wind in the mouth. So our body is also made of wind. All these hours of breath contemplation, you're like, yeah, I get it. And then lastly, let's consider the heat in the mouth, the warmth in the mouth, the fire element. What does the warmth of the mouth actually feel like? Thank you. This body made of water, earth, wind, and fire. So this, the mindfulness, the foundations of mindfulness, the suggestion is not just to kind of know it's there, but to really know it. What it, you know, what are its qualities? What's its nature? And we're also encouraged in this, the end of the body section, to consider how temporary this situation is, having a body. And here, in most Western teachings of the sutra, they skip a bunch, because there's a long section about the contemplation of the decomposition of the body. This does not sell you tickets to workshops. In great detail, the Buddha suggests actually going and sitting by a decomposing body. It's true. And considering that this is the nature of your body too. But it's very thoroughgoing, you know, like there's different things to contemplate about a 5-day-old body versus a 10-day-old body, but I will not get into it. But I was thinking about it, you know, and it may be the Buddha's intent had something to do with the cultural norm of the day. Maybe the 5th century BC Indian people like really loved their bodies just the way they were. And the images we have of them, they're like, they have nice hairdos and they're well coiffed and mostly long hair, actually, men and women, long hair. So it's an act of renunciation to cut your hair. So maybe they're a little attached to the beauty of their body. And it's helpful to contemplate the decomposition of the body. But it seems like we have the opposite problem. We basically think our body is awful, right? You know, in some way, you know. We have varying degrees of this, and it's mostly pretty mild, and I'm sure we're pretty accepting of our body, or, you know, we wouldn't have done all this practice. But if you consider your body, or you look at your body in the mirror, what comes to mind? Is your body just right? Oh, I'm so glad. Look at this body, it's perfect. Probably not. A little too this, a little too that. The skin issue is embarrassing, you know, and so on. So maybe we need a similar contemplation that has to do with actually accepting the body as the body exactly as it is, which is maybe exactly what we've been doing. So there's a process to do all these things together, which is repeated for all four foundations. Considering both the existence of these things and their nature, the practitioner is invited to remain established in the observation of the body in the body, diligent, with clear understanding, mindful, having abandoned every craving and every distaste for this life. So not just observing, in other words, observing with clarity. Sometimes maybe mindfulness sounds like a little more simple than it is, you know, just be, you know, just be with it. That's an essential root for sure. But then let's also bring our intelligence online and see with clarity, what is this really? What am I sensing? What am I feeling? And here there's some subtle work to do around not spinning off into the usual speculation and planning and judgment and analysis that we do. It's a little different way of using the mind to consider the nature of what we're experiencing. And then also to consider this from many different perspectives. And here I was trying to say this at some length in the first talk, the way we have a sort of single perspective on our life, don't you think? A sort of a little bit outside of our own life looking in. And not always too enamored by what we see. So the Buddha has a way of working with this quality by having us switch our perspective back and forth. This is the very end of the section. This is how the practitioner remains established in the observation of the body in the body. Observation of the body from inside the body, or observation from the outside of the body, or observation of the body from both the inside and the outside. So the exact way to do this, I don't think, has been passed down to us, but just to look at everything, deliberately taking different stance and different views and different perspectives. What's really here? What is this life really from the inside, from the outside, from the inside and the outside? So this is a kind of mental kind of yoga, kind kind of perceptual yoga, to deliberately move our perspective around in our inner and outer space. And then also, along with that, in the very same paragraph, to consider that the body is maybe not quite here in the solid and enduring way we think it is. Maybe like everything, it has the nature of arising, appearing in some way, and vanishing again. It says, he remains established in the observation of the process of coming to be in the body and the process of dissolution in the body, and both the process of coming to be, the process of dissolution. Or he is mindful of the fact there is a body here until understanding and full awareness come about. He remains established in the observation, free, not caught up in any worldly consideration. That is how to practice observation of the body in the body. So this thought of coming and going of phenomena is really a deep thought in Buddhism. And our week-long retreat like this is a fantastic opportunity to have some experience of this. But we tend to think stuff is here, right? The hall is here, I am here, you are here, the trees are here. And it's sort of like solidly here until sometime later we know it's not permanent, right? We're not fooled by that. We know sometime later we won't be here. The hall won't be here. That tree won't be here. But we kind of think there's an intermediate time when it really is completely just stably here. And the Buddha is reminding us in all of his teachings that that's a bit of an illusion, that we're seeing some kind of surface. The surface itself is changing constantly, but everything that constitutes that appearance, that surface, is constantly coming into being and going again, coming and going. That what we take to be sort of really exactly right here, right now, is a very temporary moment of lots of things that came together in the right way to generate this tree-ness, this me-ness, this you-ness. And we can look at this in meditation when we look at mental phenomena. Some thought arises. As we slow down a little bit, we start to see how unstable it is, how quickly it shifts and changes. There may be a way, if it's a thought that's sort of sticky to us, compelling to us, that we very quickly sort of regenerate it or regenerate another version of it, so it seems like it's persisting in the mind. But actually, as we slow down and we look, we see the elements that constitute that thought arise and they cease, and they arise and they cease. Things constantly moving and changing. And the level of the extent to which things are impermanent and changing is like more radical than our mind can quite take in. That it's not the case that things exist for a little while and then later on, they change. So that they're always changing. And we can get into like kind of molecular and atomic science to look at that too, right? My little substitute lectern looks so solid, but we know, you know, that the atoms and molecules that make it up are almost all space and are made of stuff that's like constantly in motion, right? The little electrons that have all these strange qualities, we don't even know where they are. We just have some probability idea of where they are, and somehow it adds up to something that looks very solid. So mindfulness of the four foundations helps us come down to this fundamental root of the nature of things. And when we sort of encounter this inherent impermanence and change, there's a couple of ways we can go with that. One possibility is we could freak out. You know, things that we always thought were solid are not solid. I'm dying now, not later. What? You know, I don't like that. Or it can be tremendously and unbelievably liberating because we don't have to fight so hard anymore to protect things, to preserve things, to keep things exactly the way they are, because they already aren't the way they are. They're constantly changing in a fluid and dynamic way. And so the next foundation helps us kind of understand this in a felt way. The next foundation has translated feelings in most of our English language texts. But the word that's used in Pali, Vedana, doesn't really map very well to feelings. Like, feelings is the best they could do in the 19th century, and nobody has figured out anything better. I've dicked around with it, but I can't come up with anything either. Sometimes it gets modified with another word to feeling tone. But what's meant here is that early on in this process of something being recognized by our organism, way before we have ideas about it and opinions about it and decide whether to identify with it and make it a part of who we are or reject it or whatever, way before all this happens, there's a little kind of friction or a little kind of twitch almost. When the senses, which includes this inner sense, as Jonas was saying, the sense of the mind cognizing thoughts, when the senses touch something, when there's some kind of encounter, contact, they call this, there's something that's seen, there's something that's heard, there's something that's felt, there's some thought that's recognized or encountered. At that moment, before much of anything else happens, and the Buddhist psychology has this very precisely mapped out, there's a little leaning. A little, I like this, don't like this, I'm not so sure about this. But this is before there was an I, so that's not the right language either. But these three possibilities are usually described as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Neutral. And if you've taken MBSR, you remember this is investigated in a certain sort of, you know, in real life way, with the pleasant events calendar and the unpleasant events calendar. But event is quite a bit downstream of this psychophysical phenomenon. And I'm a big fan of this foundation. I think this really helps us a lot to explore this. So we're really lucky that we get to be on retreat together and listen to these teachings from the Buddha about feeling tone. So feelings isn't right because emotion is a much more elaborated thing. Involves our conditioning, involves our history, involves our personality, right? Involves lots of thoughts and sort of impulses. This feeling tone, this Vedana, is a little below all that. It's kind of like a valence of our experience. So feeling tone isn't bad. A felt sense below the feeling. And that this drives the whole show is pretty much the way it's thought about. From there, we elaborate. Other inputs come in, a whole complicated thing happens, but there's a little impulse, a little momentum, a little energy that's nudged us already before we even knew we got nudged. And we kind of know this, like that kind of like, feeling, right? Or, feeling. Before we quite figure out what it is we're responding to, right? We have a little pulling away, a little leaning towards, or in the case of neutral, a little confusion. Like, what? Here we go. So that's maybe the best way to talk about Vedana in English, is without English words. So we can start to tune into this a little bit as we slow down in meditation. We can start to notice the many pleasant and unpleasant and neutral qualities of every moment of our existence, every moment of our experience. And these little ways that this is shifting us around is maybe another answer. I'm forgetting his name. Malinda? No. Munindra's expression, Munindra's expression, that this is simple but not easy, because we got this going on, and we didn't know it, you know? We got this little valence happening that's pushing us around because we're not mindful of it. Another example of this expression in the Zen tradition is a very famous poem from the 6th century early on in Zen in China, a long poem about the nature of mind and the nature of suffering, begins with a really simple statement. The great way is not difficult. Simply put aside picking and choosing. The great way is not difficult. Simply put aside picking and choosing. So this is kind of a radical practice with this Vedana, to notice our preferences and let them go. Notice our preferences and let them go. And retreat's such a great place to study this because the things that we get a little worked up about at retreat, for the most part, if we're honest with ourselves, don't really matter, right? Everything's taken care of. All we have to do is sit, stand, walk, eat, go to the toilet, you know? Nothing we have to do. And yet, we have opinions, right? Someone was telling me that they were fairly new to this kind of thing and were really surprised by the intricacy of the schedule, you know, and a little like, oh my gosh, really? And then by the second day, we're already upset when Jonas changed the schedule. We made a little alteration. So very quickly, we're picking and choosing. And in the very same object, in this case, the schedule, we can have unpleasant, okay, oh, I don't know about this, and pleasant, oh, I'm starting to get this, and unpleasant, oh, they changed it, right? So starting to slow down and notice before we've elaborated too much, before we are too well developed with our view and our opinion and the five reasons why we are right and they are wrong, if that's our conditioning, or the five reasons why we are wrong and they are probably right, but we don't understand it, depending if that's our conditioning. Same thing. And one of the things that's interesting about all this is there's kind of a fundamental difference here beneath the covers that we need to recognize, and that we're inherently kind of playing this on both sides of the street here. And it has to do with this basic nature of things, coming and going, coming and going. But a minute ago I said the phrase Buddhist psychology, but I was thinking on the way over here, that's a kind of an oxymoronic phrase, because psychology has the root psyche, which seems to be some sort of persistent, you know, self, right? There's some something. That's a psyche, that's me. And the Buddhist idea is, well, actually, no. That's not the case. It's just everything comes together in a certain pattern in every moment of existence. So we slow things down a lot, we may see that a little bit. Here's a moment of existence. There's a little less of a sense of me. It's just this breath, just this thought, just this emotion, just this impulse, just this pleasant, just this unpleasant. And then it changes again. And that somehow our tricky mind imputes a kind of continuity, which seems to be the self. So Buddhism and Western thought have a very different idea about the nature of the self. And so this really affects our study of Vedana, because is it me having preferences? Or is it a preference that's somehow arising in this sphere of experience that I call me because I don't know what else to call it? And those two ideas have a very different kind of quality, right? If it's not exactly me, if it's another experience, then is the idea they should have cooled down these hard-boiled eggs a lot longer, they would have been much easier to peel, what's wrong with these people? Is that any different from a tree? Is that any different from the breeze? Is that any different from an exhalation? And it doesn't have quite the same freight, right? But of course, the idea about the hard-boiled eggs is already a fairly elaborate idea. First, there's that moment of you hit the egg with your spoon and you expect a certain result, right? Or maybe you start to peel it and you expect a certain result, and then you start getting this idea that it's not what you want. Unpleasant, right? Unpleasant. A moment ago, pleasant. Oh, hard-boiled egg, how nice, you know, protein, good. Oh, unpleasant. So Vedana is in the sort of chain of causation that the Buddhists describe in this non-psyche psychology. Is the conditioning factor for something that Jonas mentioned yesterday. Very important in understanding how to be free from suffering, how to be happier, how to be resilient in a bigger way than even that word implies. Remember, Jonas was talking about the Buddha describing a certain kind of grabbiness, right? A certain kind of persistent desire that just grabs hold of just about everything. We want more of this, we want less of that, we want something we don't have, we don't want something we do have. And the word the Buddha used is actually the word for thirst. Tanha, thirst. So the way the Buddhists understand it is it's this vedana, it's this feeling tone, it's this pleasant, unpleasant. That's what gives rise to that. That's what allows that to arise. So it's on that root, this little root of like this little bit of friction, like, oh, nice, ooh, that's nice. That this persistent kind of desire that things be other than the way they actually are arises, and then a whole world of human suffering and confusion emerges from that. But that sounds a little negative. No wonder Buddhism has a bad rap. At the same time, what emerges from all that is culture and creativity and our brilliance. So it's a mixed bag, you know, it's a mixed bag. But wouldn't it be nice if we could understand this a little more clearly, a little more deeply? And I think we really could have a lot more of the beauty that emerges from these factors and a lot less of the suffering. So by simplifying our experience, we can start to feel into pleasant and unpleasant. We can start to study the second foundation of mindfulness. And the beauty of the practice of naming this is it can really help our busy, super speed minds to refrain a little bit from the elaboration upon which we build ourself and become so rigid, you know, so rigid about things that I suppose are important. We get rigid about important things, but we also get rigid about really unimportant things. And so why don't we practice with the, let's be easy on ourselves, you know. Let's practice with the low-hanging fruit, you know. Opinions about an arbitrarily created meditation schedule, you know. Really? Opinions about, you know, how they hard-boil the eggs, you know. Opinions about, I had an opinion arise in my mind about the spacing of the little rustic cabins. I thought, well, why didn't they make such a wide aisle here? If they made a smaller aisle, it would have used up less land, and maybe they could have, then you're off from there. Why do they have so much lawn here? You have some native plants. And I guess church people in the 50s didn't really think about native plants, and anyway. So it takes the smallest of perceptions, driven by vedana, leading to this kind of thirst for something to be different from it is, that we elaborate. And, you know, at best, use our mind in a pretty unproductive way. And at worst, create war, right? Create division. Create hate. So here's Thich Nhat Hanh's retelling what the Buddha actually said. And we'll go a little bit on this and then close. Bhikkhus, remember about bhikkhus? Monks and nuns and serious practitioners, so that's us. That's us. I like the way Jonas said that. Bhikkhus, how does practitioner remain established in the observation of the feelings in the feelings? Remember, feelings is this technical word. Well, whenever the practitioner has a pleasant feeling, she is aware. I am experiencing a pleasant feeling. Whenever he has a painful feeling, he is aware. I am experiencing a painful feeling or an unpleasant feeling. Whenever she is experiencing a feeling which is neither pleasant nor painful, she is aware. I am experiencing a neutral feeling. So that's the first part. Just recognizing. Oh, unpleasant. And it's interesting to me that Tay chose to put the pronoun I in here. We don't even need that, I think. It doesn't have to be I am experiencing pleasant. It can be just pleasant. You know, just get it down to the fundamentals. He's trying to make it accessible. So that'd be great to practice that way for about a week. And you're already tired of hearing us talk about the breath and the body. So I'll give you a twofer so you can stay entertained. So once you've investigated that thoroughly, pleasant, unpleasant, pleasant, unpleasant, then investigate a little bit, just like with the nature of the body. What is the nature of these pleasant and unpleasant experiences? Like, what's their sort of basis? And Tidanhan has a few suggestions. Maybe the basis is in the body. We should be able to notice that after all this body study. I'm experiencing a pleasant feeling based in the body. Some pleasant feeling based in the body. Is that where it's coming from? Or maybe the pleasant feeling is based in the mind. It's based in the mind. So to discern, there's a sense of pleasant here. Is it based in the body or the mind? And the original text actually makes a slightly different distinction, which maybe we won't spend a lot of time on. So every teacher is trying to figure out a way to make this relevant and clear. But where are these feelings coming from? The body, the mind. I had a very pleasant feeling based in the mind a little earlier walking around. Mentioned my teacher again. I don't always talk about my teacher, but somehow this week. That I've been here many times with my teacher, helping him to organize retreats, and he was teaching the retreat. Now we're kind of like co-leading it to some extent. Mostly he's in charge. And I was just remembering a time when I was walking behind him, just walking, you know, down that same walkway that we walk back and forth on, just walking behind him. And he was walking, you know, I don't know if he was deliberately thinking to himself, I am walking mindfully to help my student Tim. I don't think so. I think he was just walking, you know. But there was a way that he was walking that helped me. Helped me to drop in to just walking. So I just had a little memory of that. I just felt so lovely, you know, so pleasant. Now you may notice when you notice a pleasant feeling, the mind has a tremendous capacity, which I think we can only call yabut. I'm sure there's a technical term, but the yabut. So you may notice your mind coming up with then a lot of reasons why that wasn't really pleasant, or you didn't deserve it, or, and you can do that with positive or negative sensations. So that's an elaboration, right? That's extra. We can notice the yeah, but, and come back, like, well, wait a minute, what was I noticing? What was the pleasant or unpleasant or neutral experience or feeling? So it's subtle stuff, but as we sort of tune into this, it's a tremendous help. It's really a huge help. And ultimately, this is completely essential because we are destined for a fairly unpleasant experience, right, in the end. Not 100% solid unpleasant, so this ability to distinguish more accurately, moment by moment by moment, pleasant and unpleasant will help us. There are definitely moments of peace, happiness, and joy as we take our last few breaths. But those will not be available to us if we cannot meet unpleasant as unpleasant. If we shut down and crank up the morphine or whatever it is we do. But why wait till then, you know? Why wait till then, you know? And I know some of you work with people in the end of life, so. And what's beautiful about that, and I was just saying, I got to reminded of this experientially just the other day, is it reminds you how precious every moment is. And the study of pleasant and unpleasant supports our ability to be actually in that precious moment. Not so derailed by our preferences, our opinions, the things we cling to. That when something presses up against those tender areas, maybe before we get defensive or before we use those old strategies, we can just notice, oh, unpleasant. I can be with that. I can be with this. It's unpleasant. And stay tuned in, Because then it passes, like all things do, to be replaced by something else. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, both, neither. Okay, so that's the second foundation of mindfulness. Let's end with a poem. Here's a little poem. I like to read this in class. Maybe you've heard this poem before. It's about the sort of elaboration of this, which is where we work, right? Alison Luderman, because even the word. Try to love everything that gets in your way. Sometimes I think I better just stop there. One line of the poem is enough. Try to love everything that gets in your way. That's the same process, right? The Chinese woman in flowered bathing caps murmuring together in Mandarin doing leg exercises in your lane while you execute 36 furious laps, one for every item on your to-do list. The heavy-bellied man who goes thrashing through the water like a horse with a harpoon stuck in its side, whose breathless tsunamis rock you from your course. Teachers all, learn to be small and swim through obstacles like a minnow without grudges or memory. Dart towards your goal, sperm to egg, thinking obstacle is another obstacle. Try to love the teenage girl idly lounging against the ladder, showing off her new tattoo. C'est vie et la mienne, this life is mine, in thick blue-black letters on her ivory instep. Be glad that she will have to look at this all her life. And keep going, swim by an uncle in the lane next to yours who is teaching his nephew how to hold his breath underwater. Even though kids aren't allowed at this hour, someday, years from now, this boy who is kicking and flailing at the exact place where you want to touch and turn will be a young man at a wedding on a boat, raising his champagne glass in a toast. When a huge wave hits, washing everyone overboard, he'll come up coughing and spitting like he is now, but he'll come up like a cork, alive. So your moment of impatience must bow in service to a larger story, because if something is in your way, it is going your way, the way of all beings, the way towards darkness, the way towards light. And I always assume when I read this poem that Alison Luderman did not have a great, you know, awakening moment in the pool, you know. She probably had a really crappy swim, really annoyed. Maybe in the, you know, the changing room or something, like, oh, you know, wait a minute. So mindfulness is that, right? Oh, wait a minute. Unpleasant, pleasant. Another moment of life, this life, the only life, the life that's new and fresh and different every time. Which is the other great advantage of a very repetitive, you know, schedule done over and over again. You would think it would be the same each day, right? Is that your experience? Is each day the same? No, you know, completely different, right? Completely different. So this is our nature, and we can really take refuge in this and embrace it and love it, even when it's completely in our way. Thanks very much.